I'm going to be talking about constructing statistical mechanical models for quantum codes, and the main new thing that we're going to introduce is how to do this for correlated noise. This is work with my supervisor, Steve Flamir, at the University of Sydney. Okay. And feel free to interrupt with questions at any time. Okay, so two main questions one might ask about a quantum code. How do I use it? How do I decode it? And how good is it? What is the threshold? You can complicate these two questions slightly. I might ask, how do I decode it optimally? I might ask about more complicated things like the fault tolerant threshold. And one of the main tools that we have to answer these questions, typically the second one is the main application, but it is related to both, is something known as the StatMac mapping, at least when restricted to the case of Pauli noise. So what is the StatMac mapping? Well, the idea is we want to take some code with some noise model that I start with and map that over to a statistical mechanical model such that the error correction properties of the code are reflected in the thermodynamic properties of the StatMac model. And then the idea is that we can apply the myriad of analytic and numerical techniques that have been developed to study StatMac models and sort of pull those back to tell us results about the codes. To be slightly more specific, so the idea is that I start with a stabilizer code with Pauli noise. I'm going to restrict to qubit stabilizer codes just for simplicity. Everything I talk about generalizes to qubit subsystem codes. And we will map that over to a disordered statistical mechanical model. That mapping will have sort of two key properties. The first is that the threshold over in the code will correspond to a phase transition in the StatMac model, and that decoding in the code will correspond to calculating partition functions, or it can be reduced to calculating partition functions, at least in the StatMac model. So as I said, I mean, the main advantage of this is that we can then apply various techniques for studying StatMac systems to learn about the code. Two specific cases are that we'll look at. I can perform Monte Carlo simulations to find the phase diagram of this model, which will allow me to get a threshold approximation. And I can use one of the various methods of calculating or approximating partition functions to get approximations of the optimal decoder. So I'm going to start by talking about our results. So the first thing is that we generalize the StatMac mapping to arbitrary subsystem codes with correlated noise. By way of example, we show numerically how even relatively mild correlations can quite significantly lower the threshold of the toric code with respect to bit flip noise. We then also give a construction to show how we can use this for not only spatially correlated noise, but also more complicated things like circuit noise, which comes up in fault tolerance. So circuit noise is where I explicitly take into account my syndrome measurement circuits and assume that they're faulty, potentially. And then finally, we show how you can actually use the StatMac mapping to get a natural family of tensor network maximum likelihood decoders, which actually generalize the decoders of Bravi, Sitar, and Vargo. Okay, so this is mostly just recapping what stabilizer codes are. The key thing that I want to highlight here is this notation. At the bottom, I'm going to use this E bar to denote the logical error classes, by which I mean every set of Paulis which are stabilizer equivalent to E. Right, so I'm going to start by sort of going through the independent case. I'm going to do so in quite different notation to the way that this construction is usually given. Because if I construct it in this way, it's actually going to quite naturally extend to the correlated case. So, okay, first a bit of notation. I'm going to use this sort of double struct commutator to denote what we call the scalar commutator. Here I just mean if these two Paulis commute, I mean plus one, otherwise I mean minus one. The key difference from the regular commutator is I just mean a number, right? This isn't an operator. Right, and this will obey the following equation. Okay, so the StatMac mapping gives the following Hamiltonian. So there's quite a bit to sort of take in here. I want to sort of point out some features. So the first is, okay, I start with a stabilizer code with some stabilizer generators. and I have a Pauli error E. So for each E, I have a Hamiltonian. That's the sense in which this is a disorder. The degrees of freedom in my Hamiltonian is little SKs, a plus or minus one, and each corresponds to a stabilizer generator. There are three parts to this Hamiltonian. The first is the coupling strengths, which I'm gonna come back to. The second is a disorder term, so this is the effect of E. And the last is the actual degrees of freedom, which show up as a product like this. So this Hamiltonian has sort of three properties. The first is that it's Ising type in the sense that each interaction is just a product of these spin variables. And the key thing is that each interaction in my Hamiltonian is given or is induced by a single site Pauli. The second is the effect of this disorder. So as I said, this scalar commutator is only ever just plus or minus one. So I'm going to start with some Ising type Hamiltonian, and this disorder is going to flip some of my bonds, right? So it's going to flip bonds from ferromagnetic to antiferromagnetic. And the last is this is sort of locality preserving, right? If I started with a local code on some lattice, this is going to give a similarly local StatMec model. So the key feature.
Should I be understanding that formula, or you will explain?
No, I'm sort of going to go into why it is the way it is. Yeah, not really, is the answer. Not necessarily. Let me say that. So the key feature, I think this is the main thing to take away. The reason it's sort of built the way it's built, you could sort of back engineer it from this property, is that it has a gauge symmetry. So you can sort of see this by using the fact that this scalar commutator is multiplicative in this sense. And the symmetry is, so if I flip any given spin and I apply the corresponding stabilizer to the error, then the error is invariant. The energy is invariant. Okay, so you can sort of see, you know, when I do this, I'm going to get negative. This is going to induce negatives here, but this is going to flip exactly the same terms. So this the idea is that this symmetry is going to capture the logical equivalence of errors, right? Among other things, it means that the partition function for a given error is always going to be the same if I apply a stabilizer, and so two logically equivalent errors will have the same partition function. We're going to see what that partition function is in a second, but yeah, that's the sort of idea. Right, so I said we're considering the independent case. I haven't really talked about the error model yet, so let's bring that in. That's where the coupling strengths are going to come from. So to say that it's independent means just that the probability of an error, a global Pauli, is just the product of these local marginals. EI denotes the action of that error on a given qubit I. And what we're going to want is that the partition function reproduces these logical class probabilities, right? In the same way that people think of, you know, the partition function as capturing all of the thermodynamic properties of a StatMec model, you can sort of think of these logical class probabilities as capturing all of the sort of error correction properties of our code. And so this is the sense in which they, you know, they're very intrinsically related. Right, so we can start by using that gauge symmetry from before. So, okay, the partition function, sum over the Gibbs weights. Using that gauge symmetry, we can always sort of flip all of these spins back to all plus one by applying the corresponding stabilizer to the disorder. And so we get a sum over the Gibbs weights for the all plus one state of the logical class. Okay, and so this is the expression that we wanted. To get that then, we need that the Gibbs weight in the all plus one state is simply the probability of the error model. That would then imply that the partition function is the logical class probability. So this is the expression that we want. How do we do that? Well, we expand it out and take a log, and we get the following expression. And now the idea is, so here we have sort of a sum with a sum over commutators. You can sort of think of that as a Fourier transform respect to the Pauli group, in a sense. So this sort of Fourier-like orthogonality condition comes in. And you can use this to invert this relationship. And we get the following condition, referred to as the Nishimori condition. Okay. So this is the constraint on our coupling strengths. such that not only do we have that gauge symmetry, but that our partition functions exactly reproduce our logical class probabilities. Okay. Yeah, and as I said, this links the behavior of both systems. Okay, so I find with the StatMech model, people get confused to what lives in what space and everything. So I'm gonna go through one example in a little bit of detail. So this is the sort of the canonical example of the StatMech mapping. It was the first ever developed, which is for the toric code with IID bit flips. So okay, I start with the toric code. So I put my spins on my edges. I'm only considering bit flip errors. So actually I only need to consider the star stabilizer. I'm considering IID bit flips, so the probability of an error on any given edge is p. Probability of no error is 1 minus p. So the first step, so we have these, so the only stabilizers we need to consider are the star type stabilizers. Each degree of freedom, so the black circles, I should say, are our qubits, and the black dots and the blue circles are the spins in our StatMech model. We'll recall that each degree of freedom corresponded to a stabilizer generator. So in this case, that means that we place one on every vertex. They are plus or minus one. The next step is the interactions. So each interaction, I said, was induced by a single site Pauli. Okay, so we can sort of consider them separately. So what matters is whether or not that which stabilizer generators that Pauli anti-commutes with in this case. So if I place down an identity, well, that commutes with everything. So that never gives you an interaction. If I place down an X, well, all of my stabilizer generators were X type. So again, no interaction. If I place down a Y, well, it's going to anti-commute with the neighbors. Same with a Z. And so these two Paulis are going to induce two-body Ising couplings. And so what we're going to be left with is the square lattice Ising model. Okay. But I haven't taken into account the disorder yet. So this is just the sort of ordered version of this Hamiltonian. So next, we take into account the disorder, and that means that instead of looking at the commutator with the stabilizers directly, I need to look at the commutator with the stabilizers times the error. And so what that's going to do is, at any given site, if I apply if I have an X error at that site, the effect is going to be to flip that bond from being ferromagnetic to antiferromagnetic. And so I can place with if there was an error, I place a plus one, otherwise I place a minus one inside of this Hamiltonian, and I get the following. If I now sort of remove the code, I get the following, which is referred to as the plus or minus J random bond Ising model. Okay? So it's square lattice Ising model with each bond being with probability 1 minus p ferromagnetic and p antiferromagnetic. Right, so a quick sort of rundown of some other sort of straightforward examples. So I said, you know, bit flip gives you random bond Ising model, the toric code. If I have independent X and Z errors, then I'm gonna get a similar sort of thing on the faces, but it's actually just gonna be two uncoupled copies of the random bond Ising model. The fact that they're uncoupled is basically reflecting the fact that in this case, you can independently decode X and Z. If I have depolarizing noise, so if I have a little bit of biased Y noise, then that means that I also get a four-body coupling between the two sublattices. And this is in some sense related to the eight-vertex model. You can do a similar sort of thing with something like the color code, for example. Here you get a sort of three-spin random bond Ising model. Again, X and Z, you get two uncoupled copies, and depolarizing noise gives you this six-body coupling between them. Okay, so this original construction, this bit flip construction, was considered in Dennis et al., which was the first paper on this, and these depolarizing cases are Hector Bomben et al. Considered. Okay, so I hinted at earlier the fact that the sort of key feature of this is that the error threshold manifests as a phase transition in the StatMech model. The sort of detailed proof of that is a little bit tricky, but I'm just going to give a sort of an idea as to why that's the case. So the key idea is to look at the following order parameter, which is the free energy cost of introducing a logical error L. So this is the free energy of the system with EL, and this is just E. And what we know is that along the Nishimori line, these just correspond to logical class probabilities. And so this simply becomes a log likelihood ratio. Now, intuitively, this is the bit that's a bit tricky to prove properly, but it can be done. You can sort of see, I mean, the intuition is, if I'm below the threshold, the logical class probabilities for a fixed syndrome should be very peaked on a single class, right? This is the intuition. That's why it's easy to decode. Whereas above the threshold, it should be very flat, right? Making it very hard to decode. And so what that implies is that below threshold, this order parameter goes to infinity, and above threshold, it goes to zero.
Okay.
There's a slight trick as to exactly what you mean by convergence in this case, but yeah, that's the idea. Okay, so this forms an order parameter, which we know either goes to infinity or zero, and so this tells you that the associated phase transition exactly corresponds to the threshold, if the code has a threshold, I should say. Yep.
You say you're not assuming any decoding algorithm, it's just...
No, so this is for optimal decoder.
So by optimal decoder, what does it...
Maximum likelihood decoder. Yeah, actually, so that'll come. Okay. So you can actually relate. So the way this is often talked about is, so I explicitly did all of this on the Nishimori line. So that's going to relate to the maximum likelihood threshold. But actually, there's a sense in which the entire phase boundary corresponds to thresholds of non-optimal decoders. So you can define a decoder which is, I fix my temperature. Think of temperature now as being a sort of parameter in my decoder.
Oh, so there are some corresponding
states. Yeah, that's right. So one of the things you can do, you fix your temperature, and you calculate the free energy of this system, and I optimize that as my decoder, the minimum free energy decoder. If I do that on the Nishimori line, basically by construction, that happens to be the maximum likelihood decoder. If I'm away from that, it's not necessarily the maximum likelihood decoder, which is why all of these numbers are to the left, because maximum likelihood is optimal. One nice limit of this, if I take the zero temperature limit, I get the so-called minimum energy decoder. The most, I think, well-known case of this is the minimum weight pair matching in the Tori code.
So how do you deal with the number of logical qubits or degenerate?
Yeah, so I'm assuming, that I'm assuming is finite.
So finite is enough to suppress
that. Yeah. Yeah, so there is a question as to whether certainly in these to make these proofs rigorous, I have to assume finite, or at least I did. It is an interesting question as to what happens when it's growing, especially so near the end. I'm going to talk about decoding. That is actually a sort of a problem there, at least naively. Yeah. So this is okay. This is meant to be a sketch of what the phase diagrams of these systems look like. Certainly in practice, they all tend to look like this. So I'm going to get two phases. I'm going to get a disordered phase and an ordered phase. I'm going to have this sort of phase boundary. Here is this Nishimori condition. The intersection, so what I argued on the previous slide was that the phase transition on the Nishimori line corresponds to the maximum likelihood threshold, the optimal threshold. Okay, so that's this point here. Which tells you that you get this sort of reentrant behavior, this nice curving behavior here. It could, in principle, be vertical, but right. And so this is the phase in which that order parameter went to zero. This is the phase in which it goes to infinity. And as I said, this bottom point is also referred to as the minimum energy threshold. And for the toric code with bit flips, that actually corresponds to minimum weight pair matching. Right.
How general this conclusion is? Does it apply to all stabilizers?
Yeah, as long as you have a threshold. I mean, so I'm assuming that there is a threshold and showing that there is a phase transition, or the other way, they're equivalent. Now, you might not have a threshold. So here I've drawn the phase boundary as sort of all the way along. It could be at some point it just ceases to have a threshold. So these phases actually might not be distinct. That's one assumption in this diagram. But certainly, if it has a threshold at all, there will be a phase transition along the Nishimori line. And if you assume that this decoder has a threshold all the way until that threshold hits zero.
So, and you don't care how quickly delta converges to zero?
So I'm assuming, there's an assumption. So if the convergence of this will relate to the convergence of the decoding probability of the optimal decoder,
right.
Which could be arbitrarily slow, I suppose. But certainly, if that converges, then this converges. We have sort of double-sided bounds to show that. If it doesn't, if there is no threshold, well, actually, then there is no phase transition, at least corresponding to this, and vice versa.
Just the reason I ask is there are some static model where
right.
There is no sharp transition, but the critical region extends.
Right, right. Yeah, you could certainly get, you could get more complicated behavior than I've sort of indicated here. To my knowledge, every StatMech model, StatMech mapping that's been considered has had a phase diagram that looks exactly like this. They've never had like phase boundaries ending or anything. You could. That would tell you very weird things about the decoder, but it could be the case. Yeah, definitely it could be. Like I can't, yeah. All the diagrams I've seen have looked like this. Let me see.
Yeah, but I'm kind of sure if you do QDIT and then noise model is more like a, because clock model has this, but it's very much.
So one thing certainly, you have an order parameter for every logical error. So certainly, if you considered toric code in which I have, independent X and Z, but my X is twice as strong as my Z, clearly I'm gonna, I'm gonna drop to a bit before I drop to nothing, right? And so this is a sort of a set of order parameters, and you could get a whole series of transitions. That's true. This sort of correspondence is sort of for each L, essentially. So yeah, you could get more complicated structures in that way, certainly. But yeah. I'm gonna come back to like an explicit example of this later as well. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to the case of correlated noise. So the idea here was, so we started with independent noise. One can sort of go back and say, well, okay, where did we actually use the independence? Did we truly need independence? Rather nicely, the answer is no. So the key thing that we needed was this sort of product structure, that it breaks up into local products. We didn't actually strictly need independence. So we're going to generalize this in the following way. We refer to these as factored distributions. So I have a set of regions, Rj. By regions, I just mean subsets of qubits. I then have some functions, phi, which map Pauli's on those regions to real numbers. And I just require that my error probabilities are just a factor, are a product of these phi's corresponding to the restriction of that error to that region. So the two key things about this, I did not require that the RJs were disjoint. That's key. If they were disjoint, then this would actually just be independent on some coarse-grained lattice. And the second is that these phi j's are not necessarily marginals. They could be more complicated. Right, so these are the models that we're going to look at. Yeah, so you could consider, suppose these are like all nearest neighbor pairs, say. So I could have,
Some local way of...
So I could have... I could have something like this, say. And so I have a factor that depends on... I could have one factor which only depends on the error on 1, 2, and then all four pairings. Yeah, I'm imagining these to be local regions, otherwise I don't get a local model, but yeah, that's the idea. Yeah, so I'm just gonna relax it to this general factored structure. So it's not gonna be nice local marginals or anything, but yeah. There's a bunch of models that are sort of sub-examples of this. So most probabilistic graphical models that people consider. So Bayesian networks, Markov random fields, Gibbs random fields, they're all examples of this. Okay. So as I sort of foreshadowed earlier, the way that I sort of set the notation and the construction up will allow me to sort of quite nicely extend to the correlated case. The key thing here is that previously each of my interactions were induced by a single site Pauli. So now instead of looking at each qubit and looking at every Pauli on that qubit, I'm going to look at each region, keep in mind that they're overlapping, and then look at every Pauli on that region. Okay. Given that my regions overlap, this means I actually do doubly count Paulis, and that is actually key. So, okay, so this is the StatMac Hamiltonian. The only real difference now is that I'm summing over regions instead of sites. Other than that, it's exactly the same. And so as long as my regions are local, all of the properties that I said before also extend. Similarly, the Nishimori condition also generalizes. Here I'm now taking this Fourier transform over the Pauli group on these regions instead of individual sites, but otherwise it works the same. And one can go back through the proof and find that that factored structure is all that you really need. And so once again, you get that the partition function reproduces the class probabilities and that the threshold equaling the phase diagram argument carries through, which is quite nice. Okay, so now we're going to look at some examples. So I'm coming back to the toric code with bit flips. The general structure now is that because I'm considering interactions induced by Paulis living on little regions, I'm just going to get longer range interactions. That's the general idea. So, well, okay, so I start with, here I started with, in the independent case, I only ever look at single qubit Paulis, and so I only ever get two body interactions in my model. Here, so the green is meant to indicate the regions on which I'm looking. Here, if I consider correlations between these two qubits, then I'm going to get this diagonal coupling as well. If I look at correlations across a plaquette in this way, then I'm going to get a four-body interaction. And correlations across a vertex give me this distance two interaction. The other idea is that once you apply the Nishimori condition, the sort of strength and magnitude of these higher order terms is going to be directly related to the correlation strength and sign. Yeah. So, okay, let me look at one of these specifically. So we consider this numerically, just sort of as an example of how you can actually use this mapping to calculate thresholds. So here we're considering errors that correlate across a plaquette in this way. So this error model would be completely described. So previously I just had to describe the marginal error rate and that was it. Now, because I have correlations across a plaquette in this way, the model is completely described by these local marginals, every pair of neighboring edges, neighboring meaning across a plaquette in a sense. But a convenient way of parameterizing things for the moment is going to be the following. So we're going to parameterize it with the marginal error rate, P. That's just so we can easily compare it to the IID case. Otherwise, we'd be comparing apples and oranges. And this correlation parameter, eta. So eta is the sort of ratio of the probability of an error given that my neighbor had an error to the probability of an error given that my neighbor didn't have an error. Okay. If this is 1, then this is an independent model. If it's greater than 1, then my error is bunched together. If it's less than 1, then they anti-bunch. Okay. So this is these are the phase diagrams I said I was going to come to. So, okay, eta equals 1 here, this independent case, is just independent bit flips. Okay, so this blue model here is the random Bondizing model. Blue, these are the phase boundaries, the blue and the red. The dotted lines are the Nishimori conditions. Blue is independent and red is bunching correlations. Okay, so I sort of said that, you know, this maximum likelihood point should be the furthest right point. You'll notice it's incredibly vertical there. That was actually, so when this was originally studied, whether or not that was vertical was an open problem. The fact that minimum weight pair matching is worse than optimal actually answers that question, which is sort of nice, but yeah. Right, so these are the phase boundaries. Here is the red one, which we simulated with Monte Carlo simulations. This noisy stuff, that's our data. And this red band, is that visible? Yeah, it's visible. This pink band is our estimate of the threshold. So the threshold is the intersection between this phase boundary and the Nishimori condition. And what we found was that the threshold went down from about 10.9-ish to about 10 under these correlations. So, you know, not insignificant effect, certainly. Okay. Right, so up until now, I've been sort of talking about spatially correlated noise. That is to say, I have some noise affect my system, potentially correlated, and then I perform a whole bunch of ideal error correction. Oh, well, that's not really realistic, right? More realistically, we would expect that our error correction circuits could themselves be faulty. So one way of modeling this is what's usually referred to as circuit noise or circuit-based noise. So the idea here is that I want to explicitly take into account whatever my error correction procedure was, including my syndrome extraction circuits, and I'm going to assume that they're noisy in some way. So the main difficulty that this poses is twofold. The first is that, well, errors tend to accumulate as you go. And the second is that, the second more obvious one, I think, is that errors, as you push them through your circuit, will tend to spread. Okay, so even if I had nice IID errors sort of at one time step, when I push them through the circuit, they tend to spread and correlate. Okay, I mean, you know, dealing with this issue, this is the thing that makes fault tolerance tricky. So, so I want to show how we can actually extend our model to deal with these spatiotemporally correlated noise processes. So just for simplicity, I'm going to consider measurement circuits of the following form. I prepare some ancillas in, let's say, the zero state. I perform a Clifford, and then I do a Pauli measurement. You could consider more complicated things like deferring measurements to later and things like that, but just for the moment, we're going to consider this setup. I'm going to assume this is a Clifford and this is a Pauli, as I said. And so for convenience, we're going to assume, without loss of generality, that our errors only ever act after the circuit, but before the measurement. It's just going to be convenient to put it there. And the idea is that I can always, even if I started with a model that was, you know, at each point in space and time, I have an IID error, say, I can always push my noise, my effective noise model through to get something living just after the circuit. Generally, it will tend to correlate things. But yeah, that's just a sort of notational convenience. Okay, so we're going to get something that looks like the following. Here I've drawn everything sort of nice and regular and single ancillas and everything just for simplicity. It didn't have to be in any way regular. So I have, so think of this direction, the horizontal direction is time and this is space. I have several rounds of measuring some subset of the stabilizer generators. And after each circuit, but just before the measurement, I'm going to assume that there's some noise affecting my qubits. For simplicity, I'm going to assume that the noise hitting each circuit is independent. You could sort of nest this construction and have that also be correlated, but let's assume it's independent for the moment. So the only correlations in this are coming from the accumulation and the spreading. Those are still present. Right, so the key idea is that instead of looking at, you know, what is the error at the end, say, we want to look at the entire error history, right? I don't want to just reconstruct what the final error is. I want to try and reconstruct what it was at every stage during this error correction procedure. Specifically, we're going to look at what the error is on these qubits, okay, these blue dots. Right, so the sort of the key thing to notice here is that if I now look at the probability of the error history, by error history I mean sort of all of these errors put together, then this just decomposes. So if I look, say, at the error on these qubits here, okay, well, it only depends on whatever this red squiggly line was, whatever error that is, and whatever the error there was on those qubits in the previous time step, right? And so this large probability distribution is just going to decompose into these local chunks, okay? Into just these conditional probabilities of the error after a given measurement. So let's say X and T refers to this highlighted circuit. The errors after that are only going to depend on the errors before that, okay? That should be an X, yeah. Here T is meant to sort of be the round of the stabilizer measurement, and X is sort of some notion of position. So that looks sort of promising. It looks like a factor distribution, but it's not quite, because well, I have a product of a time here, right? It's not, these regions are now space-time regions. So in essence, the problem with the diagram is that arrow there. So we just do that. So the idea is, instead of considering these as being the same qubit at every point in time, I'm just going to lay everything out and consider these now to be distinct qubits, right? So if I had a two-dimensional thing, well, 2 plus 1, I now consider it to be a three-dimensional code. And so now if I then interpret this equation with this not being time anymore, then this is precisely a factor distribution, right? One thing I should say, this is also, so specifically, this is a Bayesian network, for those who know about that sort of thing. Right, so this is a construction we refer to as a history code. So the idea was that we deal with these spatiotemporally correlated noises, noise processes, by mapping over to this history code, such that the what was spatiotemporally correlated becomes purely spatially correlated, albeit in one dimension higher. So this is sort of a sketch of how this works. So as I said, we place qubits at every point in space and time. A key point that makes this sort of work relatively nicely is that you explicitly include the measurement ancilla. Andrew Landau was actually trying to work on doing a very similar thing to this without including the ancillas, and it's a mess. He couldn't get it to work, as it turns out. Right, and so now, well, I've told you we've sort of constructed it so that we know what the noise model is. What's the code now? So the code that we refer to is this history code. So the stabilizers of this code are just going to correspond now to the measurements, okay? Just acting on these measurement ancillas, except at the final step when it's the original stabilizers. Because I've sort of had to consider ideal measurements here for error correction to still be well-defined, the final time step is sort of special, but yeah. And the logical errors now correspond to the logicals of the original code acting on the final qubits. These two sets both... assume I spelled that correctly. These two sets implicitly define the code, and this is actually now, if I started with a stabilizer code, going to be a gauge code, a subsystem code. One can engineer what the gauge generators are given these. They are local, but those are sort of the defining features. And so now the idea is that the circuit noise on my original code now becomes purely spatially correlated noise on this history code, where I've explicitly baked in the effect of these circuits and pushing through these circuits. And so now, because of that, the fault-tolerant threshold and fault-tolerant decoding of the original code now just correspond to doing the same things to the history code. Yeah. OK, so finally, I'm going to return to the question of decoding. So up until now, I've mostly talked about thresholds, which has been the main application of the StatMag mapping, but it does actually tell you about decoding as well. So, okay, what does a decoder have to do? So some error E occurs. I measure the stabilizer generators to get the syndrome. It then has to decide which degenerate logical error class that error corresponded to, okay? And those classes are always going to look like, well, the actual logical class it did belong to, and then that differing by logical errors. The optimal decoder, the maximum likelihood decoder, is going to be the decoder which just goes through all of these classes. So here the finite logical qubit assumption sort of comes in. I'm assuming this is some finite list. It goes through this list and it finds whichever class has the highest probability. Okay. So that's the so-called maximum likelihood condition. The difficulty in this, the thing that makes this not sort of trivial to do, these classes are going to be exponentially large generally. Okay, so it's the sort of implicit sum in this that is the sort of difficult thing. So sort of the whole point of the StatMag mapping is that these logical class probabilities just become partition functions. And so now this maximum likelihood condition becomes the following. And so what this lets us do is it lets us take as any black box method we have of calculating or approximating partition functions and directly applying that to get an approximation of the maximum likelihood decoder. So to be a little bit more explicit, the idea here is I measure my syndrome, S. I construct an arbitrary error, CS, which has the correct syndrome. It doesn't have to be a particularly likely error, just some canonical error. I then calculate for every logical, so this is again the finite logical qubit assumption is coming in. For every logical error I could have, I calculate the corresponding partition function to that error. I then get some finite list of numbers. I pick whichever one is the largest. And then I take the corresponding error, and I take that to be the error that I could and invert. Okay. Right. And so the suboptimal decoders I was referring to earlier would be when you do all of this, but I don't do it at the Nishimori point. I do it at some other temperature. Here?
Yeah,
so I'm assuming that you have some way of approximating partition functions, say. I'm going to come to a specific example in the next slide. Ideally, you would exactly calculate them, and then this is just the maximum likelihood decoder. But certainly below threshold, you actually expect that of these partition functions, one is very large, and then all the rest are small. And so actually approximating certainly below threshold, you would expect that to be pretty good, depending on how good your approximation is.
Any approximation method has an interpretation of the decoder.
Yeah, you can directly construct a decoder out of it, yeah. So the specific example I had in mind, maybe this isn't the most obvious way of approximating partition functions, but it is one way, is writing them out as tensor networks and then approximately contracting those. So the idea here is that if I apply all of this construction to two-dimensional codes, like the toric code, then I'm going to get out, once I crank the handle on this construction, I'm going to get out some 2D tensor network. It's going to be a bit messier than that, but yeah, some 2D tensor network. Now, I might hope to exactly contract it. 2D tensor network, it's sharply hard. I can't exactly do it. But there are pretty effective approximate contraction schemes. So these are the approximations I was referring to. The most obvious is something usually referred to as MPS-MPO contraction. So here I take each column, I contract it into the next, I get this sort of doubled up column, and then I use MPS truncation. Now, the nice thing about this procedure specifically is that if you apply it to the toric code, you exactly reproduce the Bravi-Suchara-Vargo decoder, which is sort of nice. We didn't expect that. And when I say exactly reproduce, every entry of every tensor is exactly the same. It's not just equivalent, it's literally the same. So the idea is now this gives you a general algorithm for any 2D code with correlated noise that for constructing a tensor network such that if you approximately contract, if you contract that, that will allow you to do optimal decoding. So this is a little sketch of an example. So if I apply that to a little chunk of, here, a 3x3 surface code, once I go through the construction, I get something that looks like this. I have a bunch of delta tensors here. These delta tensors basically are performing the sum over stabilizers. And I have little tensors here corresponding to my noise model. Here is the noise model. And this, the value of this tensor network is exactly the class probability. So today I've shown how you can extend the StatMac mapping to correlated models. I also talked sort of briefly about how you can use this for not just spatially correlated, but also space-time correlated, such as the circuit noise. We've shown how you can use this numerically to evaluate thresholds of correlated bit flips, at least in a proof of principle way. And we've also shown how the StatMac mapping can also be used to give decoders, such as a tensor network, maximum likelihood decoder. There's a bunch of questions that obviously suggest themselves. One is whether there's any experimentally relevant correlated models. This correlated model that I did numerics on, that was just sort of the simplest to simulate. One could also ask if there are actually, what correlated models are seen in experimental devices. So we can actually sort of extend this beyond stabilizer codes to any abelian quantum double, you might wonder whether you can sort of extend that beyond non-abelian models. The main difficulty there is not so much the construction, it's the interpretation. Exactly what it means to error correct in that case is a little tricky. You could also ask about non-stochastic noise, non-Pauli noise, coherent noise. These are some things I'm working on. And so I gave this example of a threshold calculation for some correlation in the toric code. I have an ongoing project with David Tuckett and Ben Brown, who are both in Sydney, looking more generally at the relationship between different forms of correlation and how they affect the threshold. So it turns out certain shapes of correlation, like the one I showed, will hurt the threshold. Others will actually help. So this would at least give you a sort of step along the way to potentially being able to engineer codes to take into account the correlation structure and applying them. Thank you. Any questions?
What happens if I have non-Pauli noise?
Yeah, so it's not actually clear. I mean, the way that we do, we really needed, in quite a few places actually, that everything was Pauli. So you get a bunch of issues. So this sort of relates, too far. So this also relates to, depends exactly what you want to relax it to. So for one thing, suppose I want to look at, one of the key things about the STATMAC mapping is that it gives you a decoder independent way of looking at thresholds. And the key thing is that you can at least easily describe an optimal decoding procedure, right? You measure all the stabilizers, then you do maximum likelihood, and then you're done. If it's not Pauli noise, it's not straight away clear. So for one thing, do you want to measure all of the stabilizers? That may actually not be optimal. I mean, sort of an extreme limit, suppose that my noise model is just a single unitary happens. Then how do I correct that? I just undo the unitary. I don't measure stabilizers or anything. That's like not optimal.
Yeah,
that's an extreme example.
You can just think about some probabilistic application unitary.
Yeah.
Single unitary.
Right. But even so, it may not be the case that it may be the case that I only want to measure some of my stabilizers, things like that. It's no longer obvious. I mean, to put it another way, if I have Pauli noise, my stabilizers don't collapse the state, right? All my measurements are deterministic once for a given Pauli. If I relax the Pauli constraint, that's no longer obvious. That's no longer true.
So the best we can do is just...
Yeah. So it's unclear. So you could. One thing that you could say is, okay, let's assume I measured all the stabilizers. Then what is the optimal thing to do from there? The way that we've done it, everything is written in terms of commutators. If I'm not dealing with Paulis, it's going to become more complicated. I think you can, I hope certainly that this construction can be generalized beyond Pauli noise. If I go beyond Pauli, logical class probabilities don't seem to be the right figure of merit anymore, for example, especially if I'm dealing with coherent noise, where everything's sort of nice and continuous and the figure of merit is not so clear anymore. There are some obvious directions, but yeah, the main issue as I see it is more the question than the like construction, right? It's exactly what do I want to have here instead.
So it's calculating this partition function.
Yeah.
Using the same method.
Yeah.
Do you have like a general result on how to bound the error in this?
No. No. Yeah. So
for these particular models, it works very well because of the specific tensors.
Yeah. I mean, it works. It varies. So rigorous bounds on error. Yeah. No. But. Yeah, so certainly, I mean, you can sort of look in, so the idea with that would be, suppose I'm just looking at toric code with bit flips, so I have to compare four classes. I get four numbers out, and I want to pick whichever one's biggest. So the thing that, you know, the thing that might help you is, as I said, below threshold, you expect one of those to be significantly bigger than the others. So if I'm getting, you know, multiplicative errors, then that's fine. One of the things that you can do is you could say, all right, I fix a bond dimension, I do this calculation, and then I do it for a bunch of bond dimensions. And I keep going until the answers that I'm getting out sort of stabilize. So I mentioned a student in Sydney, David Tuckett, has been sort of doing this. So he did some work on the color code version of BSV, and then he was looking at biased Y noise in the toric code, and now he's looking at these correlated models as well. Yeah, it's sort of a mixed story. So with the biased Y noise, for example, if you have almost no bias or very high bias, meaning almost exclusively Y noise, then this thing works like you works perfectly at bond dimension of like 8, which is like nothing, right? If you have a moderate amount of Y noise, he has to go to like 48. It sort of slows down quite a bit. But so the key thing there is that you have, so you sort of have these four classes that you need to measure. And so I get, you know, I get some number out here, and I get some number out here, and some number, and some number, right? And as I said, you sort of expect one of them to be quite a bit larger. Now, what he was largely looking at was, you know, calculating it for one bond dimension, and then another one, and then another, and then another, and waiting until it sort of stabilized out. But in the end, all you actually care about is which one is biggest, right? So you just care that they're not crossing. And if you ask, when does the actual value of the partition function seem to stop moving, it can be quite high. If you ask when do they stop crossing each other, it tends to be very low. So I think for even like the worst case, he was getting like 10, bond dimensions of 10, which is not very difficult at all. Yeah. So no general results. Certainly in practice, it seems to work very well for like locally correlated things in the toric code and color code.
Is it worth considering the relation between the size of the correlated regions?
That's another issue. So at the moment, let me say a little bit about what we're working on at the moment. So certainly the hope would be, so some of the models that we wanted to look at, and this will probably come up if we wanted to relate it to experimental models, you would sort of hope at some point I can sort of truncate my correlations at some length and it shouldn't really significantly affect things. And one of the things we would like to look at is showing that that's the case, at least in practice. So at the moment, we're just sticking to toric code with bit flips just for simplicity. So the example I gave was those correlations. So they tend to hurt you. One way you can sort of see this is for x, it's trying to build little strings, right? So you can actually prove in the limit of sort of arbitrarily large bunching, the threshold goes to 0, and arbitrarily low bunching goes to 50%, sort of trivially. So we're also looking at this across vertex case. Here it's exactly the opposite. And then the slightly trickier to simulate setup is nearest neighbor. So one model that we were looking at was, suppose these are superconducting qubits, for example, and I have crosstalk. You can actually model that as, if you try and model that in this form, you'd basically get two-body correlations that will die off, that will, I think it was a power law decay, if I remember correctly. One of the things that we were thinking about looking at was, okay, take that power law decay, cut it off at some length, simulate it, see what you get, cut it off at longer length, and you know, see how much it's moved, essentially. It's definitely something worth looking at, I think. We don't really have anything on that yet, but yeah, I think that's an interesting question. Yeah. Yep.
So this things apply to subsystem calls too?
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it by just basically look at stabilizer generators?
No, you look at the gauge generators. And it's going to work in basically the same way. Every time I talked about the sort of the set of stabilizer equivalent errors, that will then become the gauge equivalent errors. Other than that, it basically works all the same. One of the reasons that works is because I never actually needed that my stabilizer is commuted. When you do things, so the key, let me write it up. The key property that basically tells you that nothing really changes is that whilst your gauge generators now don't commute, they commute under the commutator, meaning, double stroke. That is the case, right? Because this just differs from this by a phase, but under the commutator it cancels out. And so for that reason, nothing really changes. You might expect to get a quite significantly different model. Not really. That's the answer. Thank you.